So by next year, we will be looking after 13 different churches. It's getting hard to find people that will make the sacrifice involved in pastoring. And that's a shame, because whilst it is a sacrifice and whilst it is a lot of work, and whilst it is a terrible job, it's also the best job in the world. And I wouldn't do anything else. So just wait till God calls you. Or I call you. I was supposed to be in Pataru next week, but because Peter and Helen are with us, I'm going to postpone that for a while. Friday afternoon, an hour or two before dark. Three crosses are standing on the Damascus Road outside of Jerusalem. With sunset, three stars visible, the Passover and the Sabbath, which coincide this year, will begin. It is offensive for everybody to have the bodies on the cross during the Passover. Of the three crosses, the people on the outside two crosses are still alive. The man in the middle has been dead for some time. The bodies need to be disposed of before the beginning of the festival. So the soldier in charge breaks the legs of the two criminals on the outside crosses. Depending on the angle of their arms, whether they are higher or wider, they will die within 10 to 15 minutes, maybe as short as 5 minutes. So breathe on the cross. You need to pull yourself up. The hanging position fixes your diaphragm, stops you from breathing. The centurion knows that the middle prisoner is already dead. He's done many crucifixions. He is an expert. So he takes a spear and he pushes it up under his rib cage, pierces his heart. He does this not so much to make sure that he is dead, but to make sure that everybody else knows that he is dead. He doesn't know it, but he's fulfilling prophecy. Not a single bone of his body will be broken. The spear brings forth a flow of blood and water. I mentioned that last week. John makes a great significance to this blood and water. It tells us that Jesus' heart has collapsed, but his blood has separated into plasma, and he's died probably of hypovolemic shock. The soldiers take the bodies down. The sky is dark. There is thunder and lightning. The centurion, looking at all this, says, "Surely this man was the Son of God. Surely this was a righteous man." There are parts of the crucifixion ritual that we don't pay much attention to. But it was normal for the bodies to be dumped onto the city refuge pit. The denial of burial was the final ignominy in crucifixion. But Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, the same one that met Jesus by night, asked about being born again, go to Pilate and they ask for the body. Under normal circumstances, such a request is likely to be turned down. But Pilate seems pleased to grant their request, perhaps for two reasons. Joseph and Nicodemus are both members of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council in Jerusalem that condemned Jesus to death. And if members of the Sanhedrin take Jesus' body, then the Sanhedrin becomes responsible for any riots or demonstrations or uprisings associated with Jesus' death. So Pilate is pleased. There's a second reason that Pilate is happy to give the body to Joseph and Nicodemus, even though it was not the normal thing. During the trial, Jesus' attitude to Pilate changes. He starts off, he doesn't much care about Jesus. He doesn't really have any reason to care about him. And even when he tries to set him free, he does so more to annoy the priests than because of Jesus himself. But as the trial goes on, Pilate's attitude seems to change. And it becomes quite obvious that he likes Jesus. Not enough to set him free. He's pleased to do something good for him. If you came to Bible study during the week, you will have discovered that Pilate is a significant figure for us. He represents all of those who want to sit on the fence. What you think about Jesus does not matter. What you want to do about Jesus does not matter. Whether you like Jesus or you do not like Jesus is of very little importance. It is what you actually do with Jesus that matters. And Pilate, he liked Jesus, but he didn't like him enough to do something about it. I will remind you that in the end, Jesus died on an Italian cross. Joseph was a prominent member of the Sanhedrin. In all likelihood, Nicodemus is also a senior member. They clearly had not agreed with the council's verdict, and I wonder how many others didn't either. They were both Pharisees, and perhaps that explains why they didn't agree. They were both secret believers. They'd kept their faith in Jesus quiet, and it was on this day that they came out of that particular closet. They take Jesus' body, and they take a large amount of myrrh and alloys, about 35 kilos. And they wrap Jesus' body in strips of material with the spices in between. The primary spice, as I said, is myrrh. You'll remember that was one of the wise men's gifts. And it points to this very day. In Jewish tradition, to give burial to somebody who could not afford burial or would not receive burial was considered to be the ultimate mitzvah, the ultimate good deed. In fact, to this very day, there are many Jewish organizations, charities set up to do just this, to give burial when no one else would. For Joe and Nick, as we will call them, there is a significant risk in doing this. First of all, handling a dead body this close to the beginning of the Passover means that they will be unclean. They will be ceremonially unclean and will not be able to eat the Passover with their families. It immediately puts them aside. There is a cost to pay for this. But also, coming out as believers, as followers of Jesus, had its own risk. And at least two-thirds of the Sanhedrin are extremely angry with them. They have made the Sanhedrin responsible for Jesus' body. When Nicodemus came to Jesus in John chapter 3, the story is left hanging. Jesus explains to him the way of salvation and what he needs to do, but we're not told whether he believes or whether he doesn't believe. It's very reassuring to find that yes, he did. He made a commitment. He believed. Joseph is obviously wealthy. He has a tomb. Tombs were expensive commodities. They were used and reused. So it would be something that would be in his family for a long time. Joseph has a new tomb, hewn into the rock, close to the city, never been used, set in a garden. All of this shouts opulence. All of this shouts wealth. Joseph really was honoring Jesus. We don't know whether this was to be the permanent burial place of Jesus or not. By the way, the common practice was for the body to remain in a tomb like this for a year or 2 years while the body decomposed, and then the bones would be put into an ossuary, which is a stone box about yay big, about yay tall, and that would be the permanent remains. When I die, this is what I want to happen. I don't want to be cremated. I don't want to be buried. I want someone to hold onto my body for a year until it decomposes and then put my bones in an ossuary. He's half serious. I would really like it, but I don't think it's ever going to happen. I can just imagine trying to explain that to the funeral director. I mentioned that the bodies of crucified people were usually thrown onto refuge dumps. That's why we have so few remains of crucified people. But 1960s, if my memory serves me right, an ossuary was found containing the bones of a crucified person. We know that because the nail that had gone through their ankle had twisted and it couldn't be extracted, so the nail remained with the body. He was crucified. There's other evidence on the body too. Joseph is fulfilling prophecy. Jesus died with criminals and was buried with the rich. It tells us so in Isaiah 53. But there's something sad here. Pilate, Nicodemus, and Joseph waited until Jesus was dead to honor him. I would rather they honored him while he was alive. So Joe and Nick prepare Jesus for burial, according to the Jewish custom. But they do it in a hurry. With the fall of darkness, the Sabbath, the Sabbaton begins, the festival begins, and no work can be done. Jesus is laid in the tomb, and a stone is placed in front of the door. The stone sits in a channel, and the channel is an incline. So to close the tomb, you roll the stone downhill. To open the tomb, you have to roll the stone uphill, making it much harder. Peter and John have stayed around. John is at the crucifixion, possibly Peter, we don't know. The other disciples have fled. The women from Galilee who accompanied Jesus, the two Marys, stayed watching the crucifixion and waited until Joseph and Nicodemus took the body and watched where Jesus was laid. And then they went home, probably to Lazarus's house. The fall of darkness ends all activity. Then the women went home and prepared spices and perfumes, but they rested on the Sabbath in accordance with the command. Somewhere around 6 p.m. on Friday, Sabbath starts. Somewhere around 6 p.m. on Saturday evening, Sabbath ends. Very limited amount of work that can be done on those days. Even a limit to the distance that you can walk, and Lazarus' house would have been beyond that distance. This is interesting, because it means that anybody who moves Jesus' body over this period, particularly with Jerusalem being so crowded with pilgrims, is going to stand out like a sore thumb. They will be breaking Sabbath, and everyone will know. All the women can do is wait. They're in grief and in shock. With nightfall on the Sabbath, the women are free to again go about their business. Somewhere during this time, either on the Friday night or on the Sabbath, the priests go to Pilate. They are worried about Jesus' body. They must have been fuming about Joseph and Nicodemus' actions. If the body stayed with the Romans, then the Romans were responsible for it. They say to Pilate, "Sir, we remember that while he was still alive, this deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.'" The final piece of evidence against Jesus in his trial was the claim that he was going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. So he was charged with blasphemy. It becomes clear from this passage that the high priest knew Jesus was talking about his own body, not talking about the temple, and yet they still used it as evidence against him. They're worried that the disciples might go and steal the body. The disciples are in no state to do this. They are confused, they are disillusioned, and most of them have not returned to Jerusalem. I can't help but think that the specter of Lazarus is behind this. He's still alive, but the idea of Lazarus is behind this. It is the resurrection of Lazarus that starts the crucifixion account. And Lazarus' resurrection is clearly seen as a type for what's going to happen to Jesus. And you kind of wonder whether the priests are actually frightened, because there's some weird stuff that's associated with Jesus' death. There's darkness over the whole earth. There are earthquakes. There are rumors of righteous people coming out of the tombs. And you wonder whether the priests are more worried about the disciples stealing the body, or they are that Jesus is actually going to rise again. Pilate says, "Take a guard. Go and make the tomb as secure as you know how." They went and made the tomb secure, put a seal on the stone, and posted a guard. "Take a guard" is problematic. The Greek is ambiguous. It could mean "take a guard," as in take some Roman soldiers with you and set guard. Or it could mean "you have a guard, use your own troops." It seems to me much more likely that Pilate's tone is dismissive. "You've got a guard, you've got your own soldiers, you know what to do, get on with it and stop worrying me." The reason for this is twofold. Pilate wants to avoid taking responsibility for Jesus' body. But when the guards are told, when the guards report, they report to the high priests. They don't report to the Romans, which suggests they're not Roman soldiers. And when they agree to tell the story that they fell asleep, well, if they were Roman soldiers, that would be immediate death. That would be punishable by death. It has to be a pretty big bribe to bribe somebody to die. The temple guard falling asleep, well, they could fall asleep as much as they liked. The guard is in place. The tomb is sealed. Breaking it is a crime. Brief comment on 3 days. Jesus said that he will be in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. If you do the maths, you will realize that Jesus is buried late on Friday night. He rises from the dead early on Sunday morning. He is in the tomb for only 36 hours. There is a famous quote from Rabbi Eliezer ben Azaria. Obviously a rabbi you've all heard of. Writing in the Mishnah. He's talking about counting the Onah. The Onah is the period between Passover and Pentecost, the 50 days, when we count those 50 days. And he says a day and a night is an Onah. And a portion of an Onah is considered a complete Onah. So in Western scientific thinking, Jesus is not in the tomb 3 days and three nights. In Jewish thinking of the time, Jesus is in the tomb 3 days and three nights. The Bible is accurate. Early evening, when darkness falls, the women prepare for the embalming of Jesus. They know that he's already been embalmed, but they probably don't trust the men to have done it properly. And they know that the men did this in a rush. Probably for them, this is a way of grieving. It's going to take time, so they wait for the morning. While it's still dark, they make their way to the tomb. Mary, and Siomi. Why do they go to the tomb? Well, there is only one reason. They go to anoint the dead. They were not expecting to find anything other than a corpse to be embalmed. This is not an act of faith. It's an act of love. It's an act of courage. But it's not an act of faith. The biggest problem they discuss on the way is how to move the stone. Mary is 50. Siomi is also 50. Mary Magdala is probably in her 30s. Maybe the three of them together can shift it, but they're not sure. What they discover is a total shock to them. What they find, well, they miss all the action. It clearly happens before the women arrive. There is an earthquake. There is an angel. The guards are laying around like dead men. It's true. They really were asleep. The stone is rolled away, and according to one of the accounts, an angel is sitting on it. As angels do. I kind of like the comedy in that. I kind of like the idea. You know, the angel that could have put himself anywhere decides to sit on the stone. By the time the women arrive, all this has happened and gone. The angels, two of the angels are still there. They don't recognize them as angels. They recognize them as people. The guards are probably gone. The angels say to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go and tell his disciples." At this point, John takes up the story. We're in John 20. And he records that Mary Magdalene comes to the disciples. Remember, she's the youngest. She runs. And she brings a garbled message of angels and an empty tomb. Mary does not bring the message that she has seen angels that have told her Jesus has arisen. What she tells them is that the body is gone. All of Jesus' followers have a total blind spot. They did not believe that Jesus was going to die, no matter how many times he told them. And they now do not believe that Jesus is going to raise from the dead. It is ironic that the chief priest seems to have more faith than they do and seems to remember better than they do. Possibly the problem here is that doubt blurs the story. Peter and John run to the tomb. Peter outruns John. I think we should rerun that. We've got John over here, or John over there, and we've got Peter sitting at the back there. We've got a number of other Peters in church. I think we should redo this. I think that should be our yearly kind of commemoration. Lazarus' house to the tomb, what's that, 5Ks, 6Ks, possibly a bit more? Yeah, we could do that. John enters in. He sees Jesus' burial clothes. He sees the headcloth lying separate from the rest of the cloths, traditionally in the shape of an egg. He sees no angels. He sees no guards. He realizes that if the linen is here and the body isn't, then it wasn't thieves, and it wasn't the priests, and it wasn't the soldiers, and he believes that Jesus is risen. The guards report to the chief priests about the angels and the earthquake. That means the chief priests know what has happened. And they're told to spread the lie that Jesus' disciples took him while they were asleep. It's not a very convincing lie. It's not very convincing that you could move a stone and take a body without waking the guards. And if the guards didn't wake, how did they know what happened? There are different theories that are given for what happened next. Maybe they went to the wrong tomb, but if they went to the wrong tomb, all they had to do was have the right tomb pointed out. Some people have suggested that someone moved the body, that maybe Joseph did intend the body to lie somewhere else. But again, all you have to do is produce the body. Then there is the swoon theory, the idea that Jesus didn't die on the cross, but he recovered in the tomb. Going through crucifixion, that's incredibly unlikely. What's more, if it were true, if Jesus did come back to life in the call of the tomb, trust me, nobody would have heralded him as the Lord of life. They would have run away from him in fear, looking like some kind of zombie. Death could not hold him. For me, the most significant proof of Jesus' resurrection is firstly that the disciples who testified to it were prepared to die for that testimony. Yes, I'll die for the truth. I won't die for a lie. But the second evidence for me is what has come to be known as the Sasha Mills theory. If you are going to lie about something that you know is a lie, well, let's try it. I left school in 1980. And I was ducks. Not that we used the word ducks. My school was not that sophisticated. I got the top exam results for the year. You'll believe me, won't you? You will believe me, right? You know, I've got a master's degree in theology. You'll believe me in that, won't you? Right, yeah. My school was in a place called Southborough on the outskirts of Tunbridge Wells. If I wander around Southborough telling everybody that I qualified top in the year, it won't take long before somebody says, "You know what? I'm sure it was Sasha Mills." Because it was. I was second. That was a miracle because I'm dyslexic and my education was a struggle. It was a miracle and also a bad school. I can lie here safely. I can't lie safely where everybody knows the truth. So if you're going to tell a lie about Jesus rising from the dead, you do it in Galilee where most of Jesus' followers are. They'll believe you. You do it in Antioch. You do it in Rome. But you don't do it in Jerusalem where everybody knows the truth and everybody can check everything out. When the disciples come public on what has happened on the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people believe in Jesus that day. Not because Peter was a great preacher, he wasn't. Simply because they had heard all the stories, they had seen the empty tomb, and they were just waiting for someone to say, this is what it means. That is a jury of 3,000 people telling you that Jesus rose from the dead. The disciples go back to the meeting place, the upper room. Mary stays. She still doesn't believe. She still thinks that somebody has moved the body. A person comes up to her. She assumes that it's the custodian, the gardener. And she asks, where have you moved the body? She assumes that Joseph and the gardener have moved the body to another tomb. Where's the body? And Jesus says to her, Mary. And she turns to him and says, Rabbi, and hugs him. She goes back to the disciples and she tells them, I have seen the Lord. Early that evening, two disciples, Cleopas and probably his wife, are going to Emmaus. Jesus appears to them. I don't have time to tell the story. An empty tomb does not mean that somebody has risen from the dead. It can mean a whole bunch of things. But Jesus starts appearing to people. And our belief in this resurrection is actually one of our proofs of orthodoxy in the church. People today still struggle to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. The disciples struggle to believe that Jesus rose from the dead until they actually met him. I don't really expect anybody to believe in the resurrection of the dead until they believe in Jesus. And once you meet Jesus, you realize that he really has risen from the dead. The disciples from Emmaus rush back to Jerusalem, find the disciples in the upper room. They are all excited. They have run the whole way, and they just want to tell people they've seen the Lord, and they arrive, and they say, we've seen Jesus! And everybody says, I know, so have we. It's the greatest anticlimax in the whole of Scripture. If Jesus is still alive, you can have a relationship with him. You can talk with him. If Jesus is still alive, then he's active. He didn't just disappear. He interacted with people, and you can expect him to speak into your life. You can expect to hear his voice, and you know that he's making intercession for you. If Jesus is risen from the dead, then everything he taught and everything he said is right, because Jesus is alive, and God proved it. If Jesus came out of the tomb, then just like on the Day of Atonement, we know that the sacrifice that he made is effective for us. Doubting Thomas, I normally get looks of with daggers from most of the Indians in church. Thomas gets a bad press. Unless I see the nail marks, unless I put my finger in his side, I will not believe. And suddenly Jesus is there. Look at my hands, look at my side. As I alluded to before, Jesus' body is healed from incredible injuries, but the nail marks remain, and the spear marks remain, marks of covenant, reminding us who Jesus is and what he did. And when he sees him, he bows down and he says, my Lord and my God. The challenge for you this time of passion and resurrection. Jesus says to him, because you have seen me, you believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Today, I believe. I believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I've told you this before. I've stood outside of the garden tomb, assuming it was Jesus' tomb, at 4 o'clock on a resurrection morning, putting up a sound system, of course. One of the most amazing moments of my life. Jesus is risen. The tomb is empty. And I know that the tomb is empty because I know that Jesus is in my life. And I know that his power is with me. And I know that because he is alive, I can live and I can serve him and I can make the most of today and I can do what he calls me to do because his power is with me. This resurrection morning, believe. Believe in the risen Lord Jesus. Believe in what he can do in your life. And live the year ahead in that power. God bless you. Enjoy your hot cross buns. And please take your crown, because I'm not sure what I'm going to do with 170 crowns.
He's still There's nothing worth more that could ever come close. No thing can compare. You're our living hope. Your presence, Lord. I've tasted and seen of the sweetest of loves, where my heart becomes free and my shame is undone. Your presence, Lord. Holy Spirit, you are welcome here. Come flood.
I'm hopping into Peck and Save this Easter to stock up on super deals store-wide. There's everything a stick man, human or bunny could ever need. Oh man, hopping's hard. How do bunnies have so much stamina? Super deals on now! Wow, my glutes!
If you've been dealing with pain, stress, or bad sleep for months, or even years, it's time to stop just pushing through it. At Alternaleaf, we make it easy to see a doctor or a nurse from home. To find out if plant-based medicine is right for you, just do a quick check online and book a video call. Give us a buzz at 0800 005 571 or head to alternaleaf.co.nz. Let's get you feeling better.
Hey, Dad. What happens if you eat a whitetail spider?
Hey, Dad. Do credit cards use actual money?
Hey, Dad. Can you pick me up? But park around the corner so no one sees you.
Hey, Dad. Are possums allowed in the house?
Hey, Dad. Can I eat leftover spaghetti? Well, what if it's been under my bed all night?
Get Spark's Kids Plan, the hotline to home with unlimited calls between you and your kids for unlimited pickups, IOUs, and life advice. T's and C's apply.
I speak the name of Jesus over you. In your hurting, in your sorrow, I will.